his hand. It smelt of damp and dust and the thick stench of old secrets that he was never meant to be privy to. For some reason he couldn't fathom, he felt repulsed by it, as if the weight of the past might be contained in its pages, ready to consume them all. Melodramatic, though, that was. He tossed the thing onto the seat, glad to be rid of it. He would give it to Rachel later, if she ever woke up. He figured he had better check his phone whilst he was at the hospital. God knows how much work he had lost in the last few days because of all this. The number of missed calls from Amy sent a cold chill through his gut. What else was life going to chuck at them? Hadn't they had enough? The message service connected him to Amy's panicked voice, telling him that his mother was missing and that someone had trashed her house. Immediately, he rang Amy's number. She answered on the second ring.
Dad, did you get my messages? We can't find Gran. I don't know where she's gone and the house is a mess. The police just left me here and I don't know what to do, she sobbed.
Wait there, I'm on my way, he said, ramming his keys into the van's ignition before he had even ended the call. By the time he pulled up outside his mother's house, the police were back. Lots of them. Amy was outside sobbing her heart out, being comforted by a female PC who was plying her with tissues. Another was keeping the neighbours back. People in white paper suits were walking in and out the house with what looked like evidence bags.
"Amy, what the hell is going on?" he shouted,
half pushing the policewoman out of the way to get to her.
"Dad, thank God. They came back just as I was waiting for you, but no one would tell me what's happening. Something bad's happened to Gran, isn't it?"
she sobbed, clutching at him. Someone waved a warrant card in front of his face.
"DC Haddon, would you mind coming with me, Mr. Jones? We have some questions."
"Oh my God, you can't arrest my dad!"
Amy shrieked hysterically, throwing herself in front of Charlie. Haddon smiled. "I'm not arresting anyone, but I do need to ask some questions. All we're going to do is sit in the car and talk for a minute, okay?" Charlie didn't cope well in such situations. Being forced to sit in the back of a police car, even without handcuffs, was stressful. In his experience, the police rarely listened to reason, and in these situations acted like hounds with the scent of blood in their noses. Haddon slid into the front seat and turned to him with a smile that Charlie assumed was meant to be reassuring. It wasn't, it just made him want to punch the smug bastard.
"Do you know the whereabouts of your mother, Mr. Jones?" Haddon asked.
"Why?"
"I'm not able to tell you at this point, but we do need to know where we can find her. It's extremely important."
Charlie wanted to mull it over, wanted a chance to work out what might be happening here, but he knew that the more he stalled, the worse it would look.
"She's at the hospital visiting my wife. Are you going to tell me what's going on now?"
"Just a moment, sir," Haddon said, climbing out of the car and moving swiftly towards a colleague, who nodded at him and pulled out his radio. Charlie strained to listen but couldn't hear anything. Haddon brought Amy over to the car. "Please wait here with your father, miss. I'll be back shortly to let you know what's happening." Bemused, Amy sat next to her father in the police car and stared out at the scene.
Chapter 38. Rachel awoke abruptly, still in the waiting room but aware that she was no longer alone. A familiar figure stood over her.
"Delia, what are you doing here?" she asked, puzzled. Delia wasn't smiling.
"It's time that you were gone,"
she said, but her voice was distant, as if she was speaking through a long tube. "Where am I going to go?" Rachel asked, still sleepy, still bleary, still not with it.
"Time you went where you belong, lady."
Rachel felt confused. "What do you mean?"
"You just won't give in, will you? After everything, you just keep bouncing back like a bad penny. I should have done this years ago."
"Done what? What's wrong, Delia?"
In one brief flash, the waiting room was gone and Rachel felt herself being sucked into darkness. Darkness so thick, so tangible that it felt like black velvet, folding itself about her and choking out all sense of reality. In sheer panic, she fought against it, tearing at it, pushing it away from her, struggling to breathe and sucking nothing but more and more blackness into her lungs. She was drowning in nothingness and fighting thin air. In all her years of nursing on the ICU, staff nurse Jane Buckle had witnessed some things, but she had never been confronted by the act of an elderly woman ripping out tubes and holding a pillow over the patient's face. In utter shock, she found herself absently observing the event as if it couldn't be happening, until a tall woman swept into the room, launched herself across the ward, and blatantly bashed the old woman across the back of the head with a chair. Then all hell broke loose. DC Haddon and his colleagues had patiently sifted through the debris in Delia's house and had come up with absolutely nothing, other than a receipt of a salutary lesson in the dangers of ordering goods from Sunday supplement magazines.
The general consensus was that Delia had trashed the place herself, but only God knew why. Frustrated, he wandered out onto the seat, stood next to Charlie's van and rummaged in his pockets for cigarettes, managed to drop his lighter in the process. As he bent to retrieve it, something on the seat of the van caught his eye. Something that looked suspiciously like an old red diary with a little lock. To Diana's shock, the chair just bounced off the old woman, who then immediately turned around and aimed a surprisingly powerful punch to the center of Diana's face. The impact sent her reeling, and a starburst of pain flooded her head. It took three nurses, two of them male, to bring Delia Jones down. And that was how Mike Ratcliffe and Angie Watson found her. Pinned to the floor, face down under the weight of a 6-foot charge nurse. Chapter 39. Amy opened the wardrobe and wrung her hand along the satins, silks and furs.
My God, Dad, have you seen this? This place is like vintage heaven. These clothes must be worth a fortune.
The fur is a bit dodgy, though. Charlie sighed and threw her another black sack.
Whatever, Amy, can we just get this place sorted out?
The activity of clearing out Rachel's flat had been profoundly depressing. It was like archiving the contents of a museum. All except Rachel's room, which had been as spartan as a nun's cell and twice as depressing because of it. He would be glad when they were done and he could close the door on the place and let the next tenant deal with the ghosts. It was a shame you couldn't ram all aspects of the past into a bin bag and take it to the tip, where it would be out of sight and out of mind. He sat on the bare mattress and watched his daughter shovel Chanel suits and Dior dresses into a black plastic sack, realizing that he felt as old and tired as the reject clothes. Amy glanced at him and paused what she was doing.
You okay?
He shook his head.
Just tired, that's all.
She tied the sack.
We should have got a house clearance firm in to do this, really.
No, I wanted to do it. I wanted to be the one who shut the door on it once and for all. Closure, as you so charmingly put it, he explained with a weak smile.
Speaking of closure, have you thought any more about what I said? About some kind of service, a memorial or something?
He shook his head.
I can't face it, too public. You wouldn't get people who genuinely wanted to pay their respects, just a bunch of voyeurs who wanted to pick over the past and speculate. There's been enough of that already.
She sat down next to him.
I know. People are pretty sick, really. All they want are the gory details, but we need to mark it somehow.
I'm going to arrange a burial, and Diana is going to give a service. Nothing religious, just a few words, and only us. I don't want anyone else there.
She nodded in agreement and laid her head on his shoulder.
When will they release the body?
I don't know. Soon, I think, once they've got all the evidence they need, I suppose. Angie Watson said she would ring and let us know. Anyway, can we change the subject now? We've still got a lot to do, he said, slapping his hands on his knees and rising wearily from the bed. Fair play, the charity shop is going to be chuffed to bits with this lot.
Are you absolutely sure this is the right thing to do, for us to just get rid of all of this?
She hung on to it all for so long. It seems a bit odd, just bagging it all up and dumping it.
Didn't do her any good, did it? Just anchored her to misery, as I see it. Let's just get it over with, shall we?
Amy just shook her head, shrugged and opened another bag. Charlie pulled up two full bags and heaved them out of the flat and down the stairs to the van. As he opened the back doors, he noticed the curtains of the ground floor flat twitch, and the face of a small Bichon Frise appeared. That meant that Miss Barnes-Harmon was watching his every move. Despite everything that had happened, she still looked at him as if he were the devil incarnate, as if elderly women were a benign force for good sake. For good measure, he gave her a polite wave. Amy came down the steps carrying another bag.
Di just rang, we need to go home. Ratcliffe has just rung up and he wants to talk to us about Gran.
He's coming round tomorrow morning.
She said the word Gran hesitantly, still worried about how he might react to it, still unable to find a better descriptor for the woman who had pretended to be his mother. Okay, whatever. Give me that, I'll pack it in the van. You run up and get some more.
She did as she was told and ran back up the steps as he wedged the bags into the van. When he went back into the house, he was surprised to find Miss Barnes-Harmon hovering in the hallway, her little dog panting at her heel.
Such a terrible, terrible shame. I was so sorry to read about what happened. It's the end of an era, and for those of us who dislike change, it always comes as a shock. Can I offer you and your daughter a cup of tea? I imagine it's thirsty work up there, she said, nodding towards the stairs where Amy was descending with another bag.
Charlie didn't know what to say. Much as he was gagging for a cuppa, he didn't feel entirely comfortable about accepting hospitality from a woman who'd called the police on him. That would be lovely, thank you,
Amy said, before Charlie could open his mouth to refuse. She pointedly ignored the censorious glance he gave her when Miss Barnes-Harmon had turned away to lead the flat into her house. Once again he found himself stepping through a portal into the past, this one a more genteel, refined era, where time had been suspended in a soft, protective manner, befitting a woman who confessed that she didn't like change. She made a decent cup of tea, though, he'd give her that, even if the piddly little cup was a pain in the ass to drink from. She'd even given them biscuits, which Charlie didn't eat, mainly because the ruddy dog was salivating and haunting his every move. Amy was making polite conversation about the antiques and how beautifully the old lady had kept them. All family pieces. Heirlooms, I suppose you'd call them. All I have left now. I don't know what it is about this house. It makes one cling to the past, she said with a wan smile. And it has quite a past. I often wonder if poor Miss Porter knew the extent of it, and how it came to be in her possession. If she did, she'd never mentioned it. I'd like to have known her better, in all honesty. I was very fond of her mother, despite her reputation. Charlie nearly choked on his tea at that. He glanced at Amy, who was blinking in shock, too. You were fond of Valerie, she blurted. Miss Barnes-Harmon laughed. Good gracious, no. I only met Valerie once, an atrocious woman in every way. A complete social dilettante, quite repulsive, she said with a shudder. Why Lillian ever made the decision to send the child to her, I will never know. I think I'd have made a better mother for poor Rachel, in all honesty. Still, I suppose someone of her persuasion couldn't be a mother, and of course the father absolutely forbade it. Much as I liked Lillian, and was of course grateful to her for providing me with this home, I have to admit she chose her lifestyle over her child. She'd never have acquired this place if she hadn't, though I always felt that the fur coats and champagne cocktails never quite filled the hole that Rachel left in her life. I don't think she ever forgave him for making her give the child up. Charlie was aware that he was opening and shutting his mouth like a landed guppy. Forgave who? Amy asked. Charlie was convinced he'd brought her up to be a mite more polite, but he wanted to know too. Her fancy man, I think they used to call them. Lillian was a kept woman, his mistress. He gave her the deeds to his house when she agreed to give Rachel up. He didn't want that kind of albatross around his neck. It wasn't conducive to the nature of their arrangement. I'm not sure she ever forgave him or herself. I'm not sure she atoned for it by leaving it to Rachel either. It did her no favours. It was Amy's turn to sit open-mouthed. Have I shocked you, dear? I was never inclined to such shenanigans myself, but we did do those things back then. We might be old, but we weren't Victorian. Far from it, the old lady laughed. Who was he? Charlie asked, finally finding his voice. Miss Barnes-Harmon tapped the side of her nose. I always knew him as Mr. Clark, but of course that wasn't his real name. I always suspected he was a minor royal. He had that air, but I honestly couldn't tell you. I wish I could. Charlie glanced at Amy. She looked back at him over her teacup, an amused look in her eyes and her brows raised so high they were disappearing under her fringe. He had to fight the urge not to snigger himself. Rachel, the illegitimate daughter of a minor royal. Chances were Mr. Clark had been some bluff businessman with delusions of grandeur to go with his bid on the side. But if the old lady wanted to soften it with a bit of romance, why disabuse her? Charlie was just relieved that the porter gene had been suitably diluted, both Rachel and his daughter. Thank goodness. For some reason, it made him feel much better. Ratcliffe wedged himself awkwardly on the edge of Charlie's sofa and accepted a cup of tea from Diana. "Tar, I'm dying for this," he said gratefully. Tea was always a welcome prop. It had the property of being able to normalize even the most bizarre situations. "You're welcome," Diana replied. "So now that we're all here and we've all got tea, you can tell us the news." Ratcliffe glanced at Charlie. "Are you happy for me to talk about this now?" Charlie nodded. "I think Diana has as much right to know what's going on as the rest of us by now." "Damn right. Bloody woman nearly broke my nose," she said, leaking some residual umbrage. Ratcliffe sighed. "Okay, here goes. The Crown Prosecution Service are not going to take it to trial. After extensive psychiatric assessment, it has been deemed that Delia Jones is unfit to stand trial. She has been assessed as mentally unstable and therefore cannot be held responsible in a court of law for her actions." Charlie hung his head. Diana nodded sagely, and with the passion of youth, Amy vented her spleen. "You mean that evil woman is going to get away with it? I don't believe it. She has utterly and completely ruined all our lives, and you're telling me that it's not even going to court. Unbelievable," she huffed, her voice saturated with disgust.
No, she's not going to get away with it at all. Under the circumstances, she will remain, for an unspecified length of time, in a secure psychiatric unit. The chances are she will never come out. If at 77 she is still capable of murder, it's unlikely she will ever be able to be treated, and she still poses a threat. She's going to be put away for the rest of her life. The lack of real justice rankled with him, too. Amy looked away. For all her bravado and rhetoric, they all knew this had hit her hard. There were only so many skeletons a girl of her age could cope with when a battalion of them came marching out of the closet. Delia Jones had dragged them out kicking and screaming, not to mention what she'd done to the girl's mother, both in the past and all too recently. Ratcliffe wiped his brow. I wanted to come and tell you myself. It means that certain aspects of the case that would have normally come out in court won't now be given in evidence. I figured you guys might have questions. What about Frances? Will she go down for a part in things? Charlie demanded, teeth gritted. The case against Frances Haynes is proceeding as planned. Between you and me, she's a stony bitch, but she's not mad. No get-out clause for her. It was a touchy subject for Charlie, and Ratcliffe knew it. Valerie's diary had revealed the true circumstances of Patsy's murder, and Charlie had, rather too late in everyone else's estimation, been exonerated. It had been Frances who had stabbed Patsy, in a fit of jealous rage over Roy, who had been sleeping with both of them but planning to leave with Patsy. Valerie had witnessed the whole thing, and had gladly passed the buck to Charlie, who as usual had found himself in the wrong place at the wrong time that day. Ratcliffe felt bizarrely responsible for the failure of the criminal justice system in this instance, finding it difficult to look Charlie in the eye.
No comfort, I know,
he mumbled apologetically, noting the tension in Charlie's jaw. What about Molly? Diana asked, gamely steering the subject away, not that there was an easier topic to divert it to. Ratcliffe glanced quickly at Charlie, relieved to find that he was now looking out of the window, avoiding everyone's gaze.
Her remains are ready for release whenever. Just let us know, and we'll make the necessary arrangements with whichever funeral director you choose.
He could feel Charlie holding in the emotion. How hard must it be for him? Finding out that the woman who raised you had killed your own mother and abducted you.
In fact, I have something for you. D.S. Watson managed to track it down. And as it's not going to court now, we thought you might like to have it.
He pulled out a faded photograph of a young, pretty woman holding a small baby. She was squinting shyly at the camera showing off the child. He held it out towards Charlie.
It's a picture of her. With you.
He didn't want to say that they had found it among Delia's smashed belongings. It would feel like rubbing salt into a wound. Charlie started to reach out for it, but let his arm drop. Instead, Ratcliffe put it on the coffee table.
I'll leave it with you.
Amy picked it up. On the back, it said in faint pencil, Molly with Philip, 1963. She stifled a sob. Charlie wasn't even Charlie now, he was Philip Kerr. Somehow this small photograph summed up the utter mess they had to sort out, and it pained Ratcliffe deeply to see them have to face it. She put it back on the table and pushed it towards her father. We need to discuss the other remains, the baby Daniel, Diana interjected, steering the topic again. We'd like to place him with Molly. It seems symbolic somehow, is that possible? Ratcliffe couldn't see why not and agreed to look into it. He would never say at this juncture, but he had a sneaking suspicion that Delia had been responsible for Daniel's death too, though Julia Ferris was adamant that the child had never drawn breath and had been stillborn. Valerie's diary had mentioned Delia's role as midwife on that occasion, and Ratcliffe wouldn't have been surprised to find that Delia had stifled the poor mite as he was born, as revenge for the botched abortion Valerie had performed on her. Everything Delia had done had been about revenge, and in Ratcliffe books that meant insane actions from a sane mind. It stuck in his throat that there would be no trial, that she would never be called to account for the lives she had destroyed, whether her victims were alive or dead. On that note, that brings us to Rachel, he said cautiously.
What about her? Charlie demanded, suddenly defensive.
Ratcliffe closed his eyes for a moment. Of all the things that emerged from this case that had harmed Charlie, what had happened to Rachel was the thing that had affected him most. He supposed she was the only one who truly mattered.
I know how difficult this is for you, but we need to discuss what happens next. Not now, Charlie said through gritted teeth. If you've finished, I have something I need to do.
With that, he stood up, grabbed his van keys, and walked out of the house. Amy shifted uncomfortably, as if she was making space for the elephant in the room.
Diana, ever the diplomat, said gently, I think he'll have to leave that one for a while. It's the one aspect of all of this that he is truly bitter about. The rest he seems able to live with, but I'm afraid Rachel is a very sore subject. Ratcliffe nodded. I understand, but we'll have to deal with it sooner or later. I know. I'll ring you when he's ready. Ratcliffe sighed, stood up, and offered her his hand. Thank you for the tea. We'll be in touch. He smiled at Amy and glanced around the pleasant living room. Only then did he notice that the photograph of Molly was gone. Charlie swung the van into the car park and switched off the engine. Checking his watch, he realized he still had 10 minutes to wait. He picked up the photograph from the dashboard and studied it, staring intently at the tiny face of the baby. Was it possible that the miniature scrunched-up features were his? When he looked at the face of Molly Kerr, he felt the vaguest, softest stirrings of memory. Just a whisper of warmth. Nothing concrete, nothing real. Just a sense of something that might have been. He'd found out a little more about this woman, his birth mother, in recent weeks. Angie Watson had been good at unearthing ancient history and old memories. In fact, Angie had been quite good at a lot of things lately. He was surprised to find himself liking the detective quite so much. Molly Kerr had been regarded as a nice kid. A nice girl from a nice home who had got herself pregnant and thrown out of her nice home. She had been young, broke, and friendless, and had ended up selling herself to get by. He wasn't sure how it made him feel. Amy had asked him if he minded that Molly had been a prostitute. He didn't. Better than a murderess. Delia had killed her for 2 reasons, from what they could gather. 1, that she had been jealous of Molly's relationship with Barrington Jones. 2, she wanted Molly's child. That was the most difficult aspect of all this. He knew that Delia had loved him in her way. She had been a good mother. A psychopath, but a good mum on face value. She had consistently destroyed his happiness in each and every way, but, oh, he could scream sometimes. He dared not think about it much, too messy, by far. But it all kept on pinging up in his head, like some demented game of nightmare whack-a-mole. Bash one thought down and another would pop up in its place, just to make him feel like he was teetering on the brink of insanity. He was so lost in his thoughts that he jumped when the passenger door opened. Sorry, didn't mean to scare you.
I was miles away, he said.
He started the engine. You didn't let on to Ratcliffe you were meeting me, did you?
Not a chance.
Are you sure you want to carry on with this? Angie asked, reaching for her seatbelt.
Yeah, I'm sure. Enough is enough. Time for everything to come out now, don't you think? No more secrets and lies.
Angie sighed and nodded her assent. Okay, let's go. At least now that there wasn't going to be a trial, her over-involvement with this would just be a matter of disapproval in certain quarters. Even so, she knew that by embarking on this venture with Charlie Jones, she was risking her reputation and possibly her career. Ratcliffe would not be a happy man if he ever found out what she'd been up to. Charlie began to drive.
So tell me, before we get there, I need to know so that I can be prepared. I want to know what kind of reaction to expect.
Pushing aside her last thread of reluctance, Angie embarked on her story and began to explain to Charlie the pattern of their investigation and how it had culminated in the arrest of his mother. A lot of this you already know, so excuse me if I'm repeating stuff, but it helps to tell it in a logical sequence. Valerie and Delia knew each other as kids. Valerie, as you know, was brought up by her aunt, who was the local abortionist. We can only suppose that Valerie was supposed to take up the mantle at some point. Anyway, we know that there was a botched abortion which left Delia unable to have children of her own, and the scandal of which alienated her from her family. From what we can gather, they're a pretty brutal family anyway, so it's likely that whatever damage was done to Delia's psyche was done a long time ago. Of course, she blamed Valerie for her misfortunes. And when she found out that Valerie had married, she approached her and more or less blackmailed her into financially supporting her. According to Valerie's diary, it was the threat of revealing her past to William Porter that swung it. When William died, Delia had already been involved in assisting the birth and likely the death of Stella's child, so by then their fates were equally intertwined. Neither would gain anything by betraying the other. They both had enough dirt on each other to bring each other's worlds crashing down. Of course, Valerie knew you couldn't possibly be Delia's child, and Delia knew not only about Valerie's history, but also about William's incestuous relationship with Stella. They were locked together in it like a stalemate.
Tell me more about the baby, Charlie asked. Why did they do what they did to it?
As I said, he was Stella's. It appears that Valerie had the idea of preserving the body and hiding it.
She wrote about having read something about mummified remains in Sicily and had applied the process to keep him. We don't know, but our guess is that she just thought it was a good way of disposing of him. We know from both the diary and Francis that Stella had fixated on the body and kept it for days. I suppose Valerie felt she had to hide it somehow. She noticed Charlie wince at the thought. I know, it's pretty sick stuff. We think that she was pretty far gone mentally even at that stage. We know that William had syphilis and it likely he passed it on to her. It's a disease that can have a profound effect on mental health in the long run, apparently, so it might explain some of the more bizarre behaviour she displayed.
Did my mother... Delia... Did she kill the baby?
Honestly, we don't know. Stella stated that she did, but she wasn't exactly reliable. The pathologist thinks not. Ratcliffe has his suspicions, and I just have to accept that we will likely never know now. Charlie gritted his teeth.
Okay, so what about Rachel? Why was she told that she was the result of incest? What the hell was all that about?
Stella claimed that Rachel was hers, but the story you told me from the London Neighbour makes more sense. She and Stella shared some DNA, but not enough to let us believe that Stella was her mother. Cousins fit the bill perfectly, though. We think, and this is sheer guesswork based on what little Frances choose to tell us, and what we can piece together, that Stella fixated on Rachel when she was a baby and convinced herself she was hers. Bizarre, I know. You know about the room in the flat with all the dolls? Yeah, grim, but it does show us that she remained obsessed with and oppressed by motherhood, babies and guilt. We do know that Lillian paid money on a regular basis to Valerie. We assume it was to finance Rachel's upbringing. She waited a moment while he digested the information. It seems that Rachel served a purpose for everyone, one way or another.
So it's not so much of a mystery why they lied to her about me, is it? He said bitterly. I don't suppose they thought there was anything unusual in it by then.
The diary tells us that Delia and Valerie hatched that plan between them. Valerie because she thought it would bring Rachel and her money home, and Delia because she wasn't prepared to let Rachel take you and Amy away from her.
Given recent and past events, I don't get why she tolerated my relationship with Rachel at all. Why not try and put a stop to it sooner? Why let it go on so long? They were pretty effective at disposing of people by then.
This was the part that Angie hadn't been looking forward to. Not that she had been relishing any of it. She took a breath. Because they both knew that Rachel had witnessed what really happened to Patsy. She actually saw the whole thing. She paused.
Charlie swung into a side road and stopped the van. What?
Before you go on, she interjected rapidly, Rachel never hid anything from you. They doped her up with her epilepsy medication. The only bit she could ever recall was seeing you come in after the event. She had no memory of the events before, well, no accessible ones anyway. In short, they were terrified of her, that one day she might remember what had really happened. They all became very frightened of what Rachel might do, say, or remember. She had the heads up on them all. While she was a child, they could discredit her, but as an adult, it was much more difficult.
Jesus Christ,
was all he could say. Like I said, she had no conscious memory of the event itself, only seeing you afterwards. As this story had unfolded during the investigation, Angie had often wondered if it was this single happening that had brought Charlie and Rachel together in later years, the two innocents clinging together. Charlie was getting angry. She could sense it.
Tell me about William, about the flat and what you found, he said, changing the subject but not necessarily into more comfortable territory.
William left the day after Daniel was born. He had been in tacit agreement with the arrangement that Delia should dispose of the issue, as Valerie described it. As it transpired, Frances and Stella closed ranks for once, and as Frances had learned a lot from her mother about how to make people pay for what they'd done, William couldn't take the thought of facing the results of his actions on a daily basis, so he left. I can't even begin to explain to you why Stella maintained a connection with him. I don't get it, so don't ask me to make sense of it. Anyway, it seems the dolls were down to him. He used to get them for Stella, God knows why. We can't work out whether it was to torture her or compensate her. Some warped, conscious thing, we think. Put it this way, I personally never thought Delia was likely to have working knowledge of Latin, so it was always likely to be someone else. Charlie had known about the thing with the dolls for a while. They had interviewed him about it when Delia had been arrested, shown him a shudder-worthy and chilling photos of the scene. It had been like looking at the stills from a bad 1980s horror film, both faintly ridiculous and the stuff of nightmares. Given Delia's penchant for collecting dolls, he had assumed it was she who had staged the Chamber of Horrors, though God knows why.
So why did she try and burn the place down?
We think Delia thought that the diary might be in there. That's what she told us, anyway. Charlie nodded. Answer me this. Why would someone with so much to hide, so much shit to cover up, keep a diary? Angie shrugged. I have no idea, but she did. I agree that it's totally odd. The only explanation I could think of was that she wanted it as some kind of insurance policy. That if anything happened to her, it would all come out and that she wouldn't be painted as the sole bad guy. Leverage, I suppose.
Charlie started up the van again. What was it again? Pekari Pegavisti.
Yeah, something like that.
It's bloody right, though, eh?
They didn't speak for a while, just drove. Eventually, Charlie said,
How much of this do you think Rachel knew?
Angie shrugged again. Not much as a child, not consciously, anyway. Frances is adamant that Rachel knew nothing, never suspected that Valerie wasn't her real mother. Didn't know that William existed, though she had seen him several times hanging around the shop. They told her that he was an old tramp. Charlie nodded as he pulled the van up in the hospital car park. He switched the engine off.
So the question is, how much should I tell her? Do I tell her at all?
Angie turned to look at him. This had aged him, but there was still an appeal about Charlie Jones. I don't know, Charlie. What would you achieve? Charlie screwed his eyes shut and shook his head. Rachel had barely survived the attack by Delia, but for some reason she had found the will to live and was now almost well enough to come home. She had come out of the experience a changed person. Better in some ways. At least willing to let go of the past and move on. She had asked him to clear the flat, and he had felt as if she were asking him to cut down the bars of her prison. He'd been glad to do it. Maybe she was just clinging to him because there was no one else. Maybe it was because he had Amy, and it was clear that she very much wanted a relationship with her child. Her legitimate, unsullied child. Whatever. She was back in his life, and it was better than it might have been under the circumstances. Part of him felt that she was owed the truth, too, but now he had heard it for himself, he had to wonder if the lies were mildly more palatable. He shook his head from side to side as if the movement might shake something loose, and everything would fall into some logical order. Angie watched him for a moment.
Can I ask you some question? Of course. What?
Do you still love her, or do you just have some warped sense of responsibility towards her? Though Angie's feelings of antipathy towards Rachel had mellowed somewhat in recent weeks, she still had reservations. Frankly, women like Rachel scared her. Too much damage. Charlie frowned at her and started to climb out of the van.
What kind of question is that?
He said, irritation peppering his tone. What are you going to do? She called, scrambling out after him.
I'm going to tell her what I think she needs to hear.
And which bits do you think she should hear? Angie asked,
aware of her apprehension.
Charlie paused and slammed the van door.
That everything is going to be okay, and whatever bits of all this bullshit that will prove it.
Rachel watched them from the window of her hospital room. Her bag was packed, her medication lay on the bed ready for her to take away, and the jagged scar that ran down her leg throbbed in time with the beating of her heart. There had been a moment when she had contemplated making her escape, but she hadn't been able to think of anywhere to run to. Now Charlie was coming, ready to save her, to take her back to his cozy little life where they could coyly play at happy families, whatever one of those was. She wasn't sure she could be saved, or that he should even try. But now that she'd found Amy, she didn't want to let go. Whether what she and Charlie had was love, she didn't know. Part of her felt she wouldn't recognize love if it leapt up and bit her skinny ass, but Diana kept saying that where there was life, there was hope. Most of her wasn't buying it, but there was a tiny stirring of something inside, like the unfurling of wings. It was the merest flutter of possibility, and that was enough. If you enjoyed My Mother the Liar, then keep listening for an exclusive extract from Anne Troup's debut thriller, The Lost Child. Chapter 1. It all began with the dead badger. Elaine had spotted it on the road to Hallow's End, lying stiff and cold near to the grass verge that edged the narrow lane. Ordinarily, she would have ignored it, just swerved past and put the sight out of her mind. However, faced with an oncoming tractor, she had no choice but to drive over the poor thing. As the rear wheels bumped over its now thrice-crushed corpse, she gave absolution to its lingering spirit with an apology, made insincere by the shudder of revulsion that accompanied it. Rural Devon seemed to be inordinately littered with roadkill. Driving over the badger had caused a jolt to the suspension, which in turn dislodged the lid of an urn. The three events set the contents of the urn, the ashes of Elaine's recently cremated mother, skittering across the boot in a cloud of gritty detritus. Remnants of the dead woman worked their way into every surface as the car rumbled over uneven tarmac. The tumbling, rolling motion helped to embed the very crumbs of Jean Ellis deep into shoes and coats and bags, where she could cling unseen. Even in death, Jean could cleave to the daughter she coveted. In this powdered state, she could nestle against Elaine's skin, work under her fingernails, and linger in the air that she would breathe. Jean had become an ethereal cloud which no one could escape. When the car drew to a halt, Jean settled for a moment, a dust storm in waiting. At the eye of that storm, a burdened soul smoldered. Elaine knew none of this as she negotiated the lanes, diligently following the signs to Hallow's End and looking out for the fork in the road that would lead to the cottage she had rented. Just past the village, she took the right fork as instructed on the booking confirmation, and within 100 yards saw a cottage which matched the photograph from the website. Sure enough, the sign on the gate read Meadowfoot Cottage, and Elaine knew she had found the right place. A graveled pull-in formed the parking space, and she pulled up there. Once out of the driving seat, she stretched her stiffened limbs and walked to the back of the car. A girl had emerged from the cottage next door and was walking towards her. "Miriam says I've got to help you with your bags," she said. Elaine smiled at her and opened the boot. She was forced to watch, helpless and appalled, as a gust of wind seized the remains of her mother and delivered them into the unsuspecting face of the teenager who was waiting to her side. "What the hell was that?" the girl demanded, spitting. She wiped at her dusty skin with the sleeve of her hoodie. Elaine quickly pulled a coat over the urn, trying to ignore the grime that sugared the fabric. "I'm so sorry. I've been having some building work done. I had a bag of plaster in here, and some must have spilt." She had to think quickly. The confabulation was in lieu of the truth. She could hardly tell the girl she'd just received a face full of cremains. Mortified, she told the girl to go inside and clean herself up. She would unload her own bags. The girl scowled and sloped off towards the neighbouring cottage, unknowingly patting clouds of dead woman from her clothes. "If that had been anyone else but you, Mother, it might have had a funny side," Elaine muttered as she shook out her coat and dusted off her luggage. She wondered how appropriate it would be to sweep one's parent into a dustpan. "I should have had you buried. Even you couldn't have got out a coffin." She scooped what she could back into the green plastic urn and screwed on the lid. She groped around the boot for a bag which she could wrap around the urn to stop it disgorging its contents again. When she had finally enclosed Jean inside a Tesco's carrier, she felt a flush of guilt. "Sorry, Mum, but you never could resist embarrassing me, that poor girl. And I know you hated Tesco, but this will have to do." To her continuing shame, her muttering was interrupted by a small cough, forcing her to turn around and face a cheery-looking, apple-cheeked woman who had been standing behind her for God knows how long. "Hi," Elaine said, acutely aware of the blush that had crept across her own cheeks. The woman took a long, appraising look at both Elaine and her car. "You must be Miss Ellis. Welcome to Hallow's End. Good journey." Elaine hastily checked the open boot. "Not too bad, thanks, though the road up here is a mite bumpy." Thankfully, the remains looked more like unused cat litter than anything else. "Is the girl okay? I think I might have upset her when she came to help me unload." "You mean Brodie? Oh, don't mind her. She's always like that. Hasn't stopped moping since she got here." The woman bent to pick up one of the bags. "Righto, follow me and I'll show you into the cottage and let you know how everything works. I'm Miriam Davies, by the way. I live next door, so any problems and I'm on the doorstep. I come in twice a week to clean and change the linen, but anything you need in the meantime, don't hesitate to ask. I look after my sister, you see. She's had a stroke, poor woman. Can't do a thing for herself, so I'm always in. And now we've got Brodie to worry about too, poor waif. Got to feel for her, really, what with her mum being poorly in the hospital." Miriam scrunched up her face as she pronounced the word hospital, making it sound like a profanity, and leaving Elaine in no doubt about which kind of hospital it was. "So all in all, I've got my hands full, but nothing's too much trouble for guests." By the time Miriam had finished talking, they were inside the holiday cottage, and she was busy straightening cushions and twitching curtains.
as if she hadn't already made the place spotless.
"So, what brings you to Hallow's End, then, Miss Ellis?" she asked, pausing her activity. Her ruddy face was expectant and smiling. Elaine took a quick glance around the room where she was to live for the next few weeks. She was looking for the clock, the source of the incessant ticking which was already grating on her. There it was, on the dresser, its face taking on the essence of a Cheshire cat. She turned her back on it. "Oh, it's Elaine, by the way. Well, I'm having some building work done at home, so need to be out of the way for a couple of weeks, and Hallow's End is where my mother was born. She died recently, so I thought I'd come and see where she grew up." She hated explaining Jean's death. It felt as though she were asking for sympathy. The anticipation of the mawkish reaction which most people heaped upon her was beginning to turn into a feeling of mild dread. She braced herself for Miriam's anticipated compassion. "I'm sorry to hear that, Elaine. That must have been very difficult for you. Still, life goes on, doesn't it?" Miriam said evenly. The matter-of-fact response was oddly refreshing. "Yes, I suppose it does. You might have known her. Her maiden name was Jean Burrows." Miriam gave the name a moment or two's thought. "No, doesn't ring a bell, and I've lived here all my life." Elaine was surprised. The village hadn't seemed exactly extensive when she had driven through, and she'd always imagined that there was an intimacy in rural communities that dictated everyone would know everyone else. But her mother had told her that the family had moved away when she was young, so perhaps it wasn't so unusual after all. "I know the family moved to Bristol a long time ago, but I'm sure there was an aunt still here. Ruby, I think." Miriam stiffened slightly. "Ruby Tyler." She stated the name with a tone of grim disapproval. The unexpected change in Miriam's efficiently cheerful persona was quite disconcerting. "I think so. I never knew her surname. She was just someone who was mentioned once or twice." It was true. Jean had never talked much about her family, or her childhood. But the never-met Aunt Ruby stood out in Elaine's memory as the lady with the cottage garden where Jean had liked to play. It was one of the few things she had been able to imagine from the snippets of information her mother was always so unwilling to share. From Miriam's reaction, it seemed that Aunt Ruby might not be the warm and cosy woman that Elaine had always pictured. "Well, I'm ever so sorry to tell you, but Ruby's been gone a long time. Must be 20 years at least now." Miriam had adopted a more conciliatory tone, as if she had consciously decided not to speak ill of the dead. "Oh, well, never mind, I'm sure I'll enjoy my stay anyway." "I'm sure you will," Miriam agreed with a degree of warmth that Elaine hadn't been expecting after the mention of Ruby. To her surprise, Miriam leaned forward and patted her on the hand. "None of us can help our family, can we?" she said. "But you seem like a nice girl. Anyway, I must get on. Esther will be wanting her tea, and God knows what Brodie's been up to since I've been gone. Well, here's your key, and don't forget, I'm across the way if you need me." As the curious little woman waddled away, her floral apron flapping against her legs, Elaine was reminded of Jemima Puddle Duck and found that she was smiling at the comparison. Despite the fact that it really did have roses around the door, the cottage wasn't quite the bucolic ideal she had imagined when she'd booked. It wasn't so much how it looked. It was quaint enough, even twee in places, right down to the wood-burning stove in the ingle nook and the horse brasses over the mantel. Now that she was alone with the mismatched furniture, the chintz and the ticking clock, it all felt slightly oppressive, as if the cottage was waiting for her to do something that would bring it to life. Though the wind buffeted the windows and forced the trees outside to look as if they had to bow and pay homage, it wasn't cold enough to light a fire, so she cast around for another way to drive the shadows out. The place needed light, it needed noise, and it needed movement. She found a radio in the kitchen and tuned it to Radio 4. Voices flooded the two rooms and she felt herself begin to relax. Having filled the kettle and set it on the stove to boil, she was happy to discover that Miriam had been kind enough to leave milk in the fridge and tea and coffee in the cupboard. She switched on a couple of lamps, letting puddles of light the colour of orange squash illuminate the gloom. Satisfied, she hauled her bags upstairs and into the whitewashed bedroom. By the time she'd put her toiletries in the bathroom and had wedged that damn clock into a cupboard, she felt as though she'd made a dent in the moribund atmosphere. Hiding the clock had established the fact that she would mark her own time in this place. It had felt like a small act of rebellion, and left Elaine feeling stupidly victorious at taking matters into her own hands. She laughed at herself for being so pathetic and settled herself onto the sofa, where she toasted Jean with a cup of tea. "Cheers, Mum. Sorry about the rough journey, but we're here now. I've brought you home." Jean lay still and quiet in the boot of the car, fortuitously unaware that she had been wrapped in a cheap plastic bag, a fact that would have offended her sensibilities no end, or that she had been returned to the last place on earth she would have chosen for her final resting place.
That Was My Mother the Liar, by Anne Troup. Read by Jenny Bede. This program was produced by ID Audio, an audiobook from HQ, an imprint of HarperCollins. Text copyright Anne Troup 2018. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers, all rights reserved. Anne Troup asserts the moral right to be identified as the author of this work. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.